Okay. I will be the first to acknowledge that delivering sermons is not my primary skill set. Now, those of you who have been subjected to them before in the past do understand that I tend to ask a lot of questions, most of which have very complex, if not non-existent, answers. I blame it when I was a kid. When I started my education in school, I would like look into a classroom and I would ask questions, like I would notice that half the boys in my class were named Steve or Bob, and the other half were named John or Mike. And I would say, why don't we name kids their own names, like individual names, so that when you say somebody's name, you know who you're talking about? It made perfect sense from my point of view. Why don't parents do that? I don't know. Well, my parents didn't go to church. Now, but they did want me and my little brother Don to at least be acquainted with some of the tenets of Christianity. So every year they would ship us off to a Sunday school at a different local church. So one year we went Baptist. The next year we went Unitarian. The year after that, Lutheran, I think. Anyway, by the time we were done in the community, I think only two denominations escaped us, and that was the Catholics and the Presbyterians. Oh, you know, I have to do, I do remember the one thing from my early Christian education. We came home, my brother and I, from Sunday school. My mom said, "Hey, what'd you learn today in church?" And my brother Don says, "We learned that Jesus was made in Japan." Well, Don hears the world a little differently than I did. And, of course, I mean, Jesus was made in Japan sounds a little bit like Bethlehem, doesn't it? Well, okay, not really. Anyways, I began my religious education. The questions began to knock on the door of my curiosity. Questions such as, okay, if you commit sins against people, and you do the most terrible, terrible evil deeds, but then you ask for forgiveness, God forgives you, then he grants you the same status as the man who performs only good deeds all of his life. So, where's the incentive to actually obey God's laws and lead a virtuous Christian life in the first place? I didn't know. So as I grew, both physically and spiritually, more questions began pounding on the door of my curiosity. If we as Christians believe that people with different colored skin than our own, well, you know, they might be, what, inferior, maybe lesser people than we are. Or if we as Christians believe that people with different sexual orientations, say gays and lesbians, well, they don't really count as normal people, do they? I mean, they're more like, you know, maybe freaks of nature, you know, maybe biological mistakes. If we really believe this, aren't we in fact accusing God of screwing up? That somehow his quality control mechanism went awry and he created millions and millions and millions of people with the wrong colored skin, and then he turned right around and he created millions and millions and millions of people with the wrong sexual orientation. So, if these people are the wrong skin color and the wrong sexual orientation, they must be mistakes. And didn't God make them? So, if we are racists, if we are bigots, are we saying that God is not perfect, that he is fallible and flawed and a failure? It turns out, and in my exhaustive research to do today for today's sermon, there is a lengthy, complex, theological answer to this very question, and it's in an ancient text I discovered. And the answer to that question is, yes, you are saying God is a screw-up, and shame on you. The ancient text is spoken. Now, look, we all know it's human nature to feel more comfortable around those who we perceive to be like us, our own kind, racially, sexually, politically, and even when it comes down to sports teams, right? So we gravitate towards those whom we identify with, because we're all part of groups. And all groups are everywhere. And as we go up the ladder of groups, we get to the very, very top. And at the very top of all the groups is the big group. It is the group that we all belong to, and it's called humanity, God's greatest creation. And sometimes I just think we forget that. Now, everybody here probably remembers what happened on the morning of January 7th this year, when two gunmen belonging to an Islamist terrorist group busted into the offices of the satirical French newspaper, Charlie Hebdo, in Paris. They killed 11 people. Why? Why? Because the newspaper published cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Cartoons. Now, granted, some interpretations of Islam assert that depictions of Muhammad are forbidden, although nowhere in the Holy Book, the Quran, does it expressly say so. Now, the Pope, as expected, immediately condemned the killings, and he told the BBC News, "You cannot insult the faith of others. You cannot make fun of the faith of others. There is a limit." But the very same day, the Pope also said this to the media: "You have an obligation to speak openly. You have that freedom." Okay, right, wait. Okay, I'm just a little confused here. All right. If you have limits on your obligations to speak out, isn't that sort of like the opposite of freedom? I don't know. In a televised interview, the Pope tells us, "It is true we cannot react violently. But if Dr. Gasparri here, a good friend of mine, would say something insulting my mother, a punch awaits him. It's normal. It's normal." What? The Pope says we cannot react violently to nonviolent provocations, but it's okay to punch someone's lights out, an overt act of violence, if someone utters a nonviolent comment against your mother. What does this all mean? I don't know. But what I do know is this. We as Christians have our own history to deal with on the topic of invoking God and Christ for inflicting violence and terror upon ourselves. The President of the United States, during a prayer breakfast in January, made the headlines when he addressed the brutal tactics of ISIS, committing unspeakable acts in the name of the Prophet. The President then cautioned us not to get on our high horses in light of our own checkered history involving Christianity. He said, "Remember the Crusades and the Inquisition. People committed terrible things in the name of Christ. In our home country, slavery and Jim Crow were all too often justified in the name of Christ." Now here's the thought, and I have so few of them that are good, so bear with me on this. When we as Christians invoke God or His Son Jesus as the motivation for committing awful acts against our own people or any other people, what does that reveal about our faith in God's power? You see, God has endured all kinds of stuff. He's endured all kinds of insults and slights and all kinds of stuff. People ignore Him. People disregard His teachings. People killed His Son. Others curse Him or openly deny His existence. Oh, by the way, I don't know if anyone knew this. I actually covered an atheist convention here in Chicago in the 1970s. And I actually got to meet with the atheist leader, Madeline Murray O'Hare. And I kind of was thrilled at the opportunity to go talk to these people and report on them, because I thought I would be able to engage with some of the atheist membership and carry on an intellectual discussion about the existence of God, pro and con. No. Didn't happen that way. The people I saw, the people I heard, were venal, vindictive hate mongers, seething with glee while ridiculing the faithful and devising crude and infantile insults to hurl at our Lord the Savior and God the Father. It was extremely disappointing. But you know what? At no time during all of this did I feel a compulsion to draw a gun or behead anybody. I just felt sorry for these poor people, all there in that room stewing in a cauldron of self-created hate. What a waste. And yet, as enlightened as we might be, there might be those among us who would feel perfectly justified in committing violence against these people because of their behavior, because of their disrespect, because of their disbelief. And you know what? I would feel sorrier for them, for they do not understand the essence of God. They do not understand or realize the weakness of their own faith. For in violently avenging perceived affronts to God, they reveal a fundamental failure to understand the almighty power of the Lord. Now, seriously, come on. Can we be so arrogant as to presume that God needs us to protect Him? To stand up for His name because He can't? Do we imagine Him to be so weak that our intervention is necessary so that we make the difference between whether His truth marches on or His truth falls down? Now, we can easily recognize these people who claim to be believers yet turn their backs on the essence of belief. We will know them by their violence. We will know them by their hatred. We will know them by their intolerance. And we will know them by their fear, because they are afraid. Now, where does that leave us? How will they know us? Now, I don't mean us as in all Christians, and I don't mean us as in all Methodists. I'm talking about us, right here, in our Redeemer's United Methodist Church. Me, you, us, right here. How will the people of the world know us? Thank you. I finally have a question I can answer. How will they know us? They will know us by our open doors, for our church is closed to no one. They will know us by our open minds, for we celebrate and embrace the intellect that the Creator gave us to think, to reason, to imagine, to create, to solve, and to help. They will know us by our open hearts, for we do not merely tolerate, we embrace. We do not merely accept, we love. And that is how they will know us, by our love, by the same steadfast love that God has shown us since the time before the Bible. Remember what Laura read from John. Here it is again in condensed form. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. This is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. There is no fear in love, but love, perfect love, drives out fear. And so finally, they will know us by our strength of faith, for we fear not. We fear not the skeptics. We fear not the haters. We fear not the intolerant, the frightened, or the vengeful, for we bask in the power and the purity of God's love. That is our strength. That is our purpose. That is who we are, and that is how they will know us. Please bow your heads for these words from Romans 2. But for those who are self-seeking and who reject the truth and follow evil, there will be wrath and anger. There will be trouble and distress for every human being who does evil, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. But glory, honor, and peace for everyone who does good, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. For God does not show favoritism. This is the word of the Lord.